Free Radio Santa Cruz 101.1 FM and www.freakradio.org. This is the Indie Newswire program. As I mentioned just a moment ago, we have on the line Jill Friedberg, filmmaker of Granito de Arena and more recently Un Poquito de Tanta Verdad. Jill, are you there?
I'm here.
Wonderful. In many ways, Poquito de Tanta Verdad is a totally different film, but it's also a follow-up to Granito de Arena on the same subject. So I guess I want to start by asking you about the process initially that led to the making of Granito de Arena. What began this journey and led you to southern Mexico and the teachers way back in, 2003?
Yeah, early 2003. I set out to make Granito de Arena, which focuses on the history of the Mexican teachers movement, which is a social movement of public school teachers in Oaxaca, but also in other states who've been struggling for over 25 years to democratize their union and also to defend public education from neoliberal education reform. And I set out to make that film out of a concern for public education in the U.S. and an apparent concern among teachers about the lack of organized resistance in the U.S. to the privatization of public education. And so the idea was to make a film that could be used by educators in the U.S. and other countries as an organizing tool and a mobilizing tool that would demonstrate that the privatization of public education is, in fact, a global process, but it's also possible to resist that process using the Mexican teachers movement as an example of that resistance. So it wasn't so much southern Mexico that was where I wanted to go to make a film, but rather that was one of the places where I saw the story that could be useful to educators in the U.S. and other countries. And in making that film, I did spend time in other states like Chiapas and in Mexico City and Michoacán, but the teachers movement really has its strongest base in Oaxaca. So that meant that I was back and forth between Seattle, where I live, and Oaxaca pretty frequently between 2003 and 2005 in making that film, and actually finished that film and premiered it in the teacher strike encampment in Oaxaca exactly 1 year before the popular uprising started in Oaxaca.
So the 2005, the June, spring 2005 strike.
Yeah, May or June 2005 was when we first showed Granito de Arena in Oaxaca.
Wow, I didn't realize that.
Yeah.
So then the popular uprising of 2006 seemed to many people who may not have been aware it beforehand, it seemed like a flashpoint. It seemed like it really, you know, jumped on to a lot of people's radar. But as you mentioned, Oaxaca is the leader of this teachers movement in many ways.
Mm-hmm.
And your first film, of course, documents the long struggle in Oaxaca and across Mexico. So of course there are precedents and ups and downs in the movement, victories and defeats, but a year after this most recent crackdown, why is Oaxaca the leader in this movement?
Well, I mean, Oaxaca is not just where the teachers movement has its strongest base and its kind of most consistent history of teacher struggle, but I mean, Oaxaca also has a very long history of community resistance in general, of indigenous resistance and organizing, and also a really long history of indigenous and community media. So, I mean, I think all of those factors came together in what we saw explode in 2006, that it wasn't just about the teachers' movement, but that it was about all these different sectors of society who have a long history of organizing at the local and the regional level, and all of whom had just reached a point of not wanting to take it anymore, and that the state governor's attack on the teachers' strike was not so much the thing that made people so upset that they were willing to come out in the streets, but rather it was just the straw that broke the camel's back after decades of injustice that had been impacting lots of different sectors of society. So I think it has more to do with that than just the strength of the teachers' movement in Oaxaca.
So that attack on June 14th, 2006 is obviously a turning point. Had you already begun filming a follow-up?
No, I hadn't. In fact, you know, when I went down to show the previous film, Granito de Harina, when I showed it to the teachers in Oaxaca in 2005, they were just beginning the process of going on the air with their community radio station, Radio Plantón, which was going to be a radio station that was organized and financed by the teachers' movement in Oaxaca, but that really was a space for anybody and everybody who wanted to come in and participate and have a program or learn how to do radio. And in the following year, I collaborated with them and helped sort of link solidarity efforts in the U.S. to the radio station in Oaxaca and get them on the air. And that was sort of my relationship to the teachers when the 2006 conflict arose, was not so much as a filmmaker, but as a sort of collaborator with them on their radio project. And when the police attacked the teacher strike in 2006, one of the first things they did was destroy that radio station and arrest the people who were on the mics at the time. And when I went down to Oaxaca a couple of weeks after the uprising had exploded, it was not so much with the intention of making another film, but rather to deliver some gear that people in the U.S. had pulled together to try to get Radio Plantón back on the air. And I took my camera with me thinking, well, who knows what's going to happen? I'll take the camera, I'll film a little bit, and if nothing else, it could be a little epilogue to put on the, you know, next version of the DVD of Granito de Arena. And it wasn't until 3,000 women took over the state television station that I realized that actually another documentary was happening before my eyes, and that in many ways it was a documentary about media in the hands of social movements.
That story is one that listeners to the station have perhaps heard before, and everyone who's seen your film has seen the documentary evidence of. But it's a wonderful story, if you wouldn't mind telling it again.
Which story?
The Kind on the Way of Takeover.
Yeah. Well, I mean, this is probably about 6 weeks into this explosion of this leaderless, horizontal, popular, nonviolent popular uprising where the majority of sectors of civil society in the capital city and throughout most of the state have placed large parts of the city and the state under popular control through massive acts of nonviolent civil disobedience, like taking over all the state government buildings and blocking all of the highways and that sort of thing. And the city became this place where you no longer saw uniformed police, where, you know, passing by any state government building, instead of seeing bureaucrats going in and out, you saw, you know, protest encampments outside. And with the destruction of the teachers' radio station in the police attack on the teachers' strike, this phenomenon of occupying media outlets had sort of been set in motion when that same day the students went and took over the university radio station and really started using it as the sort of central organizing tool for the movement. but there was also a very powerful propaganda campaign on the commercial media, but also on the state media, which is the state television and radio station that had basically become the voice of the governor, which was, you know, the governor was the removal of the governor from the power was the central demand of this whole uprising, very repressive, corrupt governor. And he had just started using the state television station to say that the people who were participating in this movement were terrorists, that they were radicals, that they were vandals, they were dangerous, they were going to harm tourists. And there was a march one day of several thousand women who wanted to demonstrate sort of the women's role in the movement, and it was a march, and they brought their pots and pans, and they made a lot of noise. And at some point in the march, spontaneously, one of the women in the march said, "Let's go take over Channel 9, which was the state television station that the governor had been using as his soapbox. And about 3,000 women went down to the state television station, kind of on the edge of the center of town. And initially, they just asked for an hour of airtime, which to them seemed perfectly reasonable, given that the state television station is paid for with their tax dollars. But the manager of the station said, you know, under no circumstances are we going to give you an hour of time on the air. So they just said, "We'll step aside then. We're taking over the station." And they did so nonviolently, because there were 3,000 housewives, and, you know, what were the 15 people working there going to do when 3,000 women walked through the doors? And they actually succeeded in keeping that station on the air for 3 full weeks, both radio and television, with really amazing programming. And it just kind of became this open forum where people from different neighborhoods and communities could come in and, you know, discuss their grievances about all the injustices that they were experiencing in their communities, and also became a really great sort of educational forum where people were sharing documentaries and all run by women.
Now, this was during the summertime.
Summer of 2006.
Yeah. How, what was the reaction of people who saw this on their televisions?
Well, for a lot of people, it appeared to be kind of an overnight, a huge overnight media literacy lesson. I mean, there's an interview with a woman in the film who just comes out and says, you know, I had been making myself stupid at home watching soap operas until the day that the women took over the TV station, and I realized, you know, that all the stuff I had been watching was worthless and it was making me stupid, and now we don't watch that kind of TV at home anymore. And I think a lot of people had that reaction. It was the first time that they had seen people who looked like them, who came from the same backgrounds as them, on television talking about experiences that were very similar to the experiences of the people who were watching the television. So I think it really... it was a huge lesson to people about the importance of media, and also a huge lesson to people about the role that the women were playing and were going to be playing in this social movement.
But unfortunately, it didn't last, and forces of state repression didn't allow this to continue for very long. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct. The state repression had been a constant, but which really escalated towards the end of August with... massive paramilitary attacks against protest encampments right within the city center, and then later federal police occupation of the city eventually took the television station off the air, but just in general created a climate of incredible violence against the movement. And despite that, the people continued to wage a full-scale, nonviolent control of the city for a few more months, at least up until the end of October, when the federal police occupied the city. So, you know, I don't want to give away everything that happens in the film, the state's response to this nonviolent social movement was a repression on a level that we have rarely seen in Mexico in recent years.
Well, speaking of the movie, I do want to mention at least several times the upcoming screening as part of the May Day Film Festival here in Santa Cruz that goes on every year. Un Poquito de Tanta Verdad will be shown on April 25th at 7 p.m. at the Cabrillo College Watsonville campus, again as part of that film festival. And then again on May Day, on May 1st at 7 p.m. At CSUMB, Cal State Monterey Bay. At the music hall. So that's an opportunity for folks listening out there to check out this film that documents the media wars. I wanted to ask you one more question about that period, and then also talk about what's happened since then.
Okay.
But at that point during the summer and fall of 2006, a sort of, and the film excellently documents this, there's a sort of media dirty war going on back with back and forth competing pirate stations, one blocking another's signal, and these station takeovers and these two competing newspapers and blockades in front of newspapers. And so can you talk about the role of radio that's kind of specific to Oaxaca City?
Yeah, I mean, the role of, there was an absolute media war going on, and the role of radio, I mean, it was absolutely fundamental in terms of the movement. It really was, not only was the medium through which the movement was able to organize itself, and we're talking about hundreds of thousands of people participating in acts of civil disobedience, the radio became the way to sort of let people know what was happening, when, and where. It also became sort of the assembly, which was the movement's decision-making structure, became kind of the assembly on the air when decisions were made about what the movement was or wasn't going to do. If the people, didn't like that decision, you would hear about it on the radio and the phone would start ringing off the hook and people would call in and say, no, we don't agree, or yes, we do agree. And then it also became the best way for the movement to defend itself when these paramilitary caravans started coming out at night and driving through the city, opening fire on protest encampments, that the radio was the medium through which people found out where barricades needed to go up to block the movement of the paramilitary caravans. And towards the end of October, just before the federal police came in and occupied the city, all of the radio stations in the city went off the air one morning, just woke up to the static, except for the station that was in the hands of the movement, which was the university station, and this new station called Citizen Radio, which was a right-wing, government-sponsored pirate, unlicensed pirate radio station that was the closest thing to textbook fascism that I've witnessed personally in my life, in the sense that it was a radio station where people, the hosts of the radio were heard saying things like, everyone in the movement has AIDS and they're raping young women at night to infect them, so in terms of just spreading lies. But it also became the radio station where people called in and turned in their neighbors when the repression sort of reached its peak in late November. You just heard people calling in and saying, you know, my neighbor's name is XYZ and his address is such and such, and he participated in the barricades or he participated in the movement, and people's homes were being raided based on the information that was shared on this radio. So it really became this, you know, the only two radio stations in town, and one was this sort of rabid right-wing pirate station that was encouraging people to go out in the streets and carry out violence against the people in the movement, and the other one was this organizing tool that was, you know, organizing this incredible social movement despite the presence of thousands of federal police in the city.
And so since that point when federal police entered the city, there was a bit of a standoff for about a month or so, and then what some people called the end of tolerance, there was just this violent crackdown where it's been difficult to find, still, a year and a half later, information about what happened that night.
Right. Yeah, I mean, it was a horrific night. The federal police basically swept the city and arrested anybody that they got their hands on of any age and any gender, whether or not they were participating in the protests or not. People were, you know, beaten and abused and moved to prisons across on the other side of the country. And a lot of people were disappeared, some of whom have yet to appear and are assumed to have been killed that night. And that same night, the federal police sort of gave cover to the local paramilitary elements who were just on the roofs of buildings with guns opening fire on people who were in the streets that night. And that really was, I mean, it was, the repression was so immediate and so brutal. And the follow-up to that, which was a kind of combination of what we were hearing on the right-wing radio station in terms of people's names and addresses being given out and actual raids and sort of sweeps of neighborhoods that were happening, was that huge numbers of people literally had to go into hiding and leave the state and in some cases leave the country. And there was a period of several months after that where there was not only very little, you know, actual mobilization, although there still was some, but also just this sense that everyone was sort of, you know, had gone back to their trenches to figure out what to do next. And I would say that the most amazing thing that's happened and continues to happen up until today in the wake of all of that is not only an increased level of community organizing in rural Oaxaca between different indigenous groups, but absolute epidemic of community radio, where in a state where there's always been a history of community radio, there's just stations going on the air left and right all over rural Oaxaca in response to what happened in 2006 in large part. And just this month, a radio station went on the air in Tlahuitotepec, which is a big municipality in the Mije region. Last week, unfortunately, two community radio activists, two young women from an indigenous station in the Triqui region, were assassinated for their participation, apparently, in this community radio station. But my point is that despite an ongoing repression, ongoing surveillance, ongoing detentions and disappearances of people, especially in the city of Oaxaca, the people of Oaxaca's response has been to continue giving themselves a voice and organizing themselves through the use of community radio, whether that be in the city or out in their rural communities.
That's, of course, one of the interesting things about the mobilization over the entirety of 2006 is that it was largely concentrated in the city. People were coming in and out of the rural areas and concentrating in the takeover was and the large encampments were largely in the capital city.
Yes and no. I mean, there really was there were over 25 municipalities who had our equivalent of like of the city hall occupied and replaced by popular government during those 6 months of conflict. And that didn't make the news as much because people weren't necessarily getting out into those communities and reporting it. But some of those communities, like Huautla de Jiménez, remained under popular control for months. Jalapa del Marqués too. So I mean, what was most on the news and what was most kind of unprecedented was the occupying of Oaxaca City. But it was also happening. It was also happening on a statewide level for the majority of the 6 months of conflict.
Mm-hmm. Now, those murders in the Triqui region that you mentioned, there are photos of these women online. Broadcasting the inauguration of a radio station in that area. Can you talk a little bit about the specifics of that community or that case, or maybe just even generally about the Triqui region of Oaxaca?
Yeah, I mean the Triqui are one of 16 indigenous groups in Oaxaca, and the municipality where this radio station had just gone on the air this past January is called San Juan Copala, and it's actually a municipality that declared autonomy in January of 2007 and is made up of over 20,000 Triqui people who live there. It's a region that's been especially plagued by paramilitary violence that the state always tries to explain as inter-community conflicts, you know, that, oh, this community and that community are warring between each other, and what can we do if the, you know, savage Indians want to kill each other off? But it's, you know, well documented that it is, in fact, state-sponsored paramilitary repression. And this radio station, The Voice That Breaks the Silence, went on the air this past January to celebrate the one-year anniversary of San Juan Copala's having declared autonomy. And these two women were, as radio hosts, one was 20 years old and one was 22 years old, were using the radio station to speak about that injustice, about paramilitary injustice, in Spanish as well as in their Triqui language. And they were, in fact, on their way to Oaxaca City to participate in a gathering, a forum, a statewide gathering about community media in Oaxaca when they were gunned down and killed on their way to Oaxaca City. There were four other people in the truck with them, a man, a woman, and their two young children, who were injured but who witnessed the killing and who saw and identified the people who pulled the trigger. Nevertheless, nobody's been held responsible. So that's in keeping with the impunity that reigns in Mexico around state-sponsored violence. That's no one's really ever been held accountable for the kinds of state-sponsored violence that we see in places like Oaxaca.
Exactly. There's no shortage of stories, unfortunately, that sound remarkably like that. But there's no doubt that these people were targeted specifically because of their work.
Correct. No, there's no doubt about that. I mean, there have been other paramilitary attacks in that region where the motives were a little, less clear. But in this case, I mean, there's no other explanation for why a 20-year-old and a 22-year-old girl basically would be gunned down by, you know, a group of men with AK-47s coming from the radio station where they worked on their way to participate in a community media conference. I think the message wasn't just trying to silence that particular radio station, but also to send a message to all of the people who are coming from all over the state to participate in the conference, who are all community makers, from community media makers from around the state. I think it was also meant to send a message to them.
And it did, no doubt. I have faith that people are continuing to organize and continuing without ceasing or without a doubt based on that attack. But I imagine the conference took on a different tone.
Yeah, I haven't talked directly to folks who were there, but I'm sure it did. I mean, a lot of the people who work. There's a whole network of community radio stations that's growing really fast that used to call itself the Community Radio Network of the Isthmus, which is one region of Oaxaca, and as the sort of community radio phenomenon has expanded, it's now the Indigenous Community Radio Network of the Southeast, or something like that, in English is the general translation. And And yeah, a lot of those people had worked with those women, had helped them to get the radio station on the air, and they were attending that conference. So I'm sure when the news arrived of what had happened, it was, really traumatic and also really terrifying for these people who then go back to their communities where they work on their community radio stations that are also in regions that are subjected to a lot of state and paramilitary violence. So, but they certainly have not stopped mobilizing and stopped organizing, that's for sure.
Is there a third film, and is this going to become a trilogy?
not that I have planned. I mean, I'm working, still putting all my time and energy into the distribution of Un Poquito de Tanta Verdad, and not so much, not just to sort of build understanding about the situation in Oaxaca, so that people can, you know, act in solidarity when necessary, but also because I think that the film really holds a lot of important lessons for people in this country, in terms of the question of the media, and where, you know, the film demonstrates what the real media landscape is like in Mexico. And it's, in fact, it's horrible, but it's better than what we have in this country in terms of the number of voices represented in the state and commercial media. So I'm hoping that people seeing the film can take some lessons away, or at least some dialogue about, you know, what do we want to do in this country in relationship to a commercial media that really controls the public debate and controls social mobilization in many ways. So I'm going to keep focusing on distribution and hope that the film can kind of add to that conversation.
So if the first film is focused at teachers, then the second film is focused at media activists, people who care about getting the word out there, looking for information that's perhaps less skewed toward one perspective or another?
Yeah, I mean, you know, Granito Arena was focusing on an audience of educators, but, you know, in fact found that the film was very useful to people who hadn't put much thought into public education, and likewise with this film. I mean, obviously I hope that it can be used as a tool by media justice movements, but that it also be useful to people whose understanding of the media doesn't necessarily go any farther than yelling at their television because they're frustrated with what they're hearing or not hearing on the news.
Well, then that film again can be seen April 25th. That's 2 weeks from today, a week from today. Next Friday night, not tonight, but next Friday night at Cabrillo College, the Watsonville campus. And on May Day, on May 1st, at CSUMB, Cal State Monterey Bay, in the Music Hall. The film is Un Poquito de Tanta Verdad. We've been talking to Jill Friedberg. Thank you very much.
Thank
for
you
your
very
time
much.
And for your work and for continuing to, again, work on the distribution of these films and really make sure that they get out there and get as widely viewed as possible.
Well, I hope folks have a chance to see the film.
The speakers at the May Day Film Festival are from the local Pajaro Valley Federation of Teachers.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm hoping that they'll be discussing connections locally,
yeah,
including someone from the Migrant Education Department here in Santa Cruz County in Watsonville and Pajaro Valley. So the connections are definitely being made between the struggles in Oaxaca and nationwide in Mexico, and the local struggles to, again, democratize the unions and have a greater voice for defenders of public education in this country as well.
Great. Well, hopefully that conversation can happen at the screening.
Thank you very much again for your time.
Thank you. You're welcome. Take care.
We'll talk to you again soon. Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.1 FM and www.freakradio.org.